We're in the money, that wacky money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the diner. I'm James Lilacs, sitting here at my accustomed place at the long boomerang pattern Formica counter. The old diner on an old Highway 23, about 18 and a half minutes from wherever you happen to be right now. And, you know, drive fast, pedal to the metal. Gas is cheap. Thought it'd get a little cheap, but didn't really expect these reasons for it. Oh, well, I'll take it. I'll take it indeed. And yes, if it sounds like we're in a chipper mood today, that's because we are. Today at the diner, we're getting rid of old man depression. Now, you might ask, isn't that somewhat of a ageist comment to take an economic crisis and reduce it to the personified form of an elderly man? Aren't we really, shouldn't we be fearing young man depression? Somebody who is very vital and has got muscles and an evil leer on his face. No, we're getting rid of old man depression because, well, as it happens, there's been a regular patron to the diner whose name is Depression. Hank. Hank Depression. And he's an old guy. And we've been pretty much tolerating him for years. You know, you'll be sitting there having fun and chatting with a nice, comely young lass who's sitting at the stool next to you. And who should come in but old man Depression? And everybody's, oh, here we go again. And it's not because, well, he reminds me of a fellow that I used to wait on in the valley, an old chronic alcoholic of advanced years. Oh, he could have been 30 for all we knew, but he looked about 70, 75 or so. And he came down to the valley every day, and he was dressed in a shabby black overcoat, and his eyes were rheumy, and his face was always sort of plagued with a sort of indistinct fear that got more fearful the drunker he got, and he got drunk. This guy got hammered on a regular basis on Valley wine, and we served the worst sort of wine you can imagine. This stuff was sweet. Everything. The dry wines were sweet. They're sweet enough to induce diabetes in a piano leg, for heaven's sakes. And he would order it up glass by glass because he still had the dignity that keeps the chronic alky perhaps from just cutting to the chase and buying the liter carafe and sitting in the back, you know, pouring it down his pants, which was where half of it ended up anyway. And he would sit there, and he wasn't even a perv. If he'd been a perv, it would have almost been something, because the valley was always stuffed with nubile, young, comely college lasses, but he was unaware of anything except the glass in front of him. And his name was Bishop Whipple. That's what he was called. The older regulars, who themselves prided their ability to get semi-drunk on a daily basis, liked the fact that he came in, because here was somebody who got just far drunker than they did, which, you know, makes a guy feel good about himself. You always need somebody to look down upon. But it took me years to realize that Bishop Whipple was actually a real historical figure in Minnesota past, and that they were calling him this as a reference to that he was not named Bishop Whipple. And whether or not he had any ecclesiastical background, I have absolutely no idea. I don't even know why they called him that. But that's what we kids called him. Hey, Bish. He never said anything to anybody. He would just push his coins across the counter in a palsied hand, and we'd give him what he knew he wanted every single night. Well, the good thing about him, you can say, he didn't stink. And if you're going to have a chronic alky at a bar who comes in all the time, it's good if he doesn't reek. Old man depression, though, I don't know. There's just it's you'd need a lava bar the size of a sofa to clean this guy off. Just decades of accumulated grot. So there you'd be talking to somebody, and old man depression would come in, and the door would bang, and the temperature would drop 5 degrees, and he'd sit down, and everybody would just sort of inch away from the thing that had come in, and he'd order coffee, one cup of coffee, and into it he would pour about 17 sugars to give him his energy for the day, and then he would eat ketchup. He would pour ketchup from the bottle into a saucer and eat the ketchup with a spoon. Now, that's a troublesome one. That's technically, that's a meal, but you can't penalize anybody for excessive condiment use. Well, I suppose you could. I mean, if somebody came in every day and spanked a bottle of Heinz until the thing was empty, called for another and drained it as well, you could maybe suggest that he go a little light, especially if he left a lake of ketchup on the plate at the end of his meal. But no, this guy would just dine on condiments. And to this day, I'm convinced that the fact that the diner no longer has those little pickle relish packets... You know, the old radio training comes in handy sometimes. I pulled my plosives instead of saying pickle packets. Radio engineers everywhere will be happy for that. It's a new test. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickle packets and pulled their plosives, along with Patricia, who had pumpkin pie at Perkins. Anyway, the reason that the diner no longer has the little Heinz pickle relish packets is because Old Man Depression would come in and have about 10 of them. He'd slice them open and squirt the contents down his throat. So here you had this muttering... Oh, he muttered, too, constantly. And he always muttered about Hoover, which was odd, because he was probably a zygote during the Hoover administration. But he would sit there and mutter and emanate pickle aromas and slurp up his ketchup and generally soaked up a lot of resources here. So eventually he did something that caused him to be expelled from the joint. He wet himself, frankly. So, as it turns out, it was not that. It was something entirely different. Well, most people don't have lymphatic incontinence, but for some odd, strange reason, he managed to lose control of his lymphatic system, and it just sort of seeped right out of his cuffs and onto the floor, and it was disgusting, so he was 86'd. 86'd. Oh, we used to use that term at the Valley, too, and we got rid of people. 86'd him. Out you go. I 86'd a few in my time. The most memorable one, of course, was Sarge, as he was known. An insane man who would sit in the back and glower at people and tote up his enemies and... Crazy guy who went really crazy and had to be expelled. I expelled him, and that may not have been the wisest thing I've ever done, because he came back later promising to kill me with a gun, which he showed to people, and I went into hiding for about 3 weeks or so. And I actually named the literary executor. I'd written about 8 things, but I wanted to make sure that they were not forgotten. So if Sarge blows my head off, please make sure that my pieces are someday given to the New Yorker so they can reject him, because I haven't been rejected by the New Yorker yet. Eventually, he was institutionalized for being insane, and I testified at a hearing. And at that hearing, he was released. And the judge, in his wisdom, commended him to my care, because the judge hadn't listened to a single thing that I said and said, I will let you go with your friend there. To which point I stood up and said, Your Honor, I am not this man's friend. And memory, of course, being what it is probably lying here, but I seem to remember a rap of a gavel and the instruction that one more outburst in the court will be cleared, which is wrong, of course, because it wasn't a court. But still, I like to think that I had some sort of Perry Mason moment there. Anyway, he was released, and then he settled down. He got on some Thorazine and eventually just plain up and died. Went and got himself dead. But 86, from what I understand, the term 86 means, when you throw somebody out, the legend has to do with it's a line in the restaurant code in New York or something like that. Which sounds good, doesn't it? I mean, it's probably nonsense. Well, first of all, who does the 86ing in a diner? That's right, the cook. Because the waitresses lack the physical presence, and you always have the big burly cook behind the grill. And you know what the cook looks like, don't you? You've seen him in the Dagwood cartoon. He's got the white paper hat, got a filthy apron that he's wearing. He's got a little anchor tattoo on his bicep. And if a customer's being unruly and needs to be ejected, the chef will come around from the grill, wiping his hands on his filthy apron, and grab the customer in the accustomed fashion, which is one meaty hand on the shirt collar and one meaty hook on his belt, his pants. And then he throws him out, face first, onto the street. Whereupon he re-enters the establishment, dusting his hands off, slapping his palms together, and saying, well, I 86'd him. Now, I don't think that the cook was back there boning up on restaurant codes and just found it fortuitous that he was able to use his newfound information in the ejection of an unruly patron. I did that to conform with the Rule 86 of the New York State Restaurant Code. Odd, too. I was just reading about it. No, I don't know where it comes from. And I should Google. I should Snopes. But it's been a long day. Then again, it's been a good one because, as I said, we got rid of Old Man Depression. That doesn't mean that he's gone completely. He's sort of wandering around the parking lot. But we'll see what we can do with him. I would... I would hate for him to get hit by a car on the highway. That would be bad. Well, maybe we should, I don't know, stake him out or something? No, you can't do that. If there's one thing that's going to cut down on the roadside traffic, it's pulling up to a place and finding a muttering bum who's, you know, chained to a stake in the parking lot. Doesn't matter if he's old man depression. People just have odd, strange reactions to things like that, so never mind. On the other hand, it's been a bit of a sad week here as we note the passing of someone who we never knew, had no personal knowledge of whatsoever, and a complete and utter stranger. And by sad, we mean, oh, well, that's too bad, but on the other hand, death comes to us all. And he was an old guy. So, what's for dessert? I mean, that's usually how it is when you're reading the obituary page, isn't it? Unless one of them hits you really hard. Well, this one didn't hit me really hard, because he was old, and he'd lived a wonderful, long life, and it's sad that he's gone, but he's a rare individual, because he's left us a great deal of stuff by which to remember him. And I speak of Neil Hefti. H-E-F-T-I. Neil Hefti was a trumpet player, a big band arranger, and a soundtrack writer. A soundtrack writer. It's the Beatles' unsuccessful follow-up to Paperback Writer. A soundtrack composer of some note in the 60s and 70s. And he is familiar to people of my generation, people who came up in the 70s, because he wrote the theme for a television show that we all watched. In retrospect, I wonder why. It being such a pale, pallid, clattering, nattering emanation of the original. And his name was always in the credits. If I recall correctly, at the end of the credits, it would have his name. Theme by Neil Hefti. And that was odd. Didn't have a lot of that. You would have it, for example, John Sebastian wrote the theme for Welcome Back, Kotter. And they put theme by John Sebastian, I think, because he was famous. He was one of the Lovin' Spoonfuls or something. The Mary Tyler Moore Show, I believe, at the end of the show had the theme, Love is All Around, sung by Sonny Curtis. And nobody knew who Sonny Curtis was. Not many. He was one of the crickets. Although whether or not he was an original cricket or a subsequent cricket or a fill-in cricket, I'm not sure. But he was a cricket, which gave him a certain connection to Buddy Holly. And given that Buddy Holly was on his way to Fargo, North Dakota, and then to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to play, boy, it all fit together, didn't it? That Mary Tyler Moore Show just hit me where I live. But this one, everybody knew the theme, and we thought perhaps that it had been written for the show. Well, it hadn't. And it's one of the most recognizable themes from the very first moments you hear the notes. Just pops right out at you. And it has the one thing that I've never heard anybody describe Hefti's music as being melancholic, but it is. There's a great sense of melancholy to this. And it makes sense given the subject matter, I suppose. So let's see if I can play and find one of my favorite versions here. I don't even know if there's any Hefti on the jukebox. Oh, good Lord. Yeah, there's lots of Hefti on the jukebox, which makes sense when you think about it. The fellow who stalks the jukebox in the middle of the night has an amazing prescient sense of what I'm going to want to play the next day. It'll be a bad day when I walk in here and see it's nothing but Elton John, because that'll mean, you know, that he's dead, and that's really going to catch him by surprise at Entertainment Weekly. They're going to have to scrap everything and scramble for that memorial cover issue. Anyway, the one that I'm looking for, the version I'm looking for, which again, from the very first notes, have that bittersweet, melancholy, sad, yet oddly jaunty and urban sound, would be here at D1. Big slob, the other's gay and quite supple. one to a gal named Doris. No, I made that up. I made that up. But they are straight. I'm just kidding. Of course, I made that up. Felix in the movie version was affirmedly heterosexual. He just seemed a little bit more Nelly-ish and fluttering in his Tony Randall incarnation. Note the Jack Lemmon version of Felix Unger was simply neurotic, which was big back then. A very fascinating new development in human personalities, the annoying urban neurotic. And it led for wonderful moments. To this day, 4 decades after seeing the original movie, when I get a pain in my lumbar region, I will just, oh, my back. I won't make the honking sounds that he tried to do to clear his sinuses, but that moment there, incidentally, where the music stopped and then resumed with the flutes, that's the moment when Felix just couldn't kill himself because the window wouldn't open. That's how much I've got that movie in my head. What a lot of people don't know, though, is that Mr. Hefty did more than that. Way, way, way before he was doing television soundtracks, he was an arranger for the Woody Herman band, the Thundering Herds, in their glory years of 45 to 47. Compare the careful, urbane, mature tune that he gave us in the Odd Couple theme to this, which is the sound of a young man with a gigantic brass section behind him. What would you do if you had this power? Well, you'd do something like this, probably, if you could. From about 1945 or so, arranged and I believe composed by Neil Hefty, The Good Earth. Yes, yes, sir. That is music to beat Hitler by. And we did with that, and we thank them. But he left the band, and he went on to work with Basie and others, and composed a few of the tunes which are still hanging around out there, favored by those who still play Bing Bad music. That would be the early Paul Whiteman Orchestra stuff where Mr. Crosby didn't have his act yet together. Bing Bad music. Big band music, which is... of course, had its brief little vogue there, thanks to Brian Setzer and the lounge craze, and has now sunk back, I'm afraid, to where it was before. Which is fine. Leave it to those of us who are purists and know what we're talking about. And I'm not one of them, because I can't tell you who played horn in Harry James' orchestra. Well, Harry James, yeah, but I mean, you know, the third guy in 42 before he was drafted. I don't know that stuff. I just know what I like. And one of the things that I took a long time to like was stuff like I'm about to play. If I can find it here. Oh, there it is. Okay. That's, incidentally, that previous one, if you stop in at the diner, was I think it was F1. So, but it won't be there long, you know, because who knows who dies tomorrow. And this one is at M2, right? But, of course, all of this stuff is available for purchase at Amazon or on iTunes and the sort. This next one is by the Frank Cap Juggernaut, which probably is a modern band, one of those bands that's bringing back the big band sound for the 900th time. It sounds too good to be from the 50s or 60s. It's a Hefty tune called Lil Darlin'. And let's put it this way. If you were very rich and very successful and very famous and had everything that you wanted in life, but you still had a nagging itch in your soul that kept you from being happy, you couldn't write something like this. It would just be beyond your ability. I think it takes a person who's at ease with himself to be able to write something like this, because it settles, the melody settles into itself with such luxurious satisfaction that you can't help but just sort of lean back in your chair and let your breath just go out as slowly as possible. Tune is Little Darlin' by Neil Hefti, and again it's by the Frank Capp Orchestra. Here's an excerpt. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. That's music for my Uncle Oving to be dancing to with his wife down in Florida. Get it out of here. All right, fine, be that way. But is it possible that Mr. Hefti could have combined that lush big band style with a more spare, stripped-down style of his soundtracks? Is it possible? Could it be? Well, let's find out, shall we? Let's conduct an experiment. There was a theme I found in a movie that I watched, part of which I saw on late-night television. It was late, and the movie just failed to impress. Lord. Even though it contained Jack Lemmon as a modern, neurotic, urban man. And a cartoonist, too, as a matter of fact. That makes two movies in which Jack Lemmon has played a modern, neurotic, urban man. The other being The War Between Men and Women, I believe, in which he plays a cartoonist based roughly, very loosely, on James Thurber. In this one, he's a newspaper comic strip artist, and the beginning of it is just this ridiculous thing where he actually reenacts on a public scene the adventure cartoon that he's about to draw so he can get it in his mind. It's just drivel. And he, of course, lives in a penthouse because, as we all know, newspaper syndicated cartoonists are incredibly wealthy and can afford to have Terry Thomas walking around. Of course, obviously, Terry Thomas didn't take advantage of his employer's dental plan because he had that famous lacuna, don't you know, right between his front teeth through which you could pass a number two pencil. So the film had Terry Thomas and it had Jack Lemmon, and it still didn't hold my interest for anything more than 20 minutes or so. But the theme, the very moment I heard the opening notes of the theme, I said, who else can this possibly be but Neil Hefti? It's the theme from How to Murder Your Wife, a comedy. And again, if you stop by, it's here at T1.
Felix Unger, Cat Burglar. Thank you.
Those strings really define the era, don't they? When you hear strings like that in an arrangement like that in a 1960s movie, you know that it's going to star some hot sex bomb, some Claudia Cardinale or some buxom Swedish kitten sex pot of the month or something who's going to be shot in a gauzy focus and speak in a charming accent and be attracted to our hero, who's really quite something of an ordinary fellow. And then he'll have sex with her and then go back to a much more traditional female as the movie concludes. I think that was the plot of about 487 movies, only half of which starred Jack Lemmon. Well, I have to take a break here for a second, if you don't mind, and I'll be right back after a word from some of our sponsors.
Who knows how to help you solve your shopping problems? Your Better Business Bureau knows.
But they advertised this chair for $50, and now they won't sell it to me. They're even trying to get me to buy one for $100. Isn't there anyone who can tell me what to do?
I can, madam.
But who are you?
I'm the man from the Better Business Bureau. And when someone advertises an item and then won't sell it to you when you come into the store, but tries to get you to purchase something at a higher price, you may be the victim of a scheme known as bait and switch. Don't fall for it. In most places, it's illegal.
Oh, sir, how can I ever thank you?
No need to thank me, madam. That's what Better Business Bureaus are for. To help consumers get a fair deal.
And now another tale of the ball and chain. As Kellogg's Special K
presents Overweight on an Overnight Train.
Is this seat taken?
Please sit down. You have exceptional legs. But why is one of them attached to a ball and chain?
This ball and chain? It's a symbol.
Funny, I would have sworn it was a ball and chain.
I mean symbolic. Because carrying around a few extra pounds can be just like lugging around this ball and chain.
I see. May I suggest something?
Uh-huh.
Try a bowl of Special K skim milk, orange juice, and coffee. It's the Special K breakfast.
Will it make me lose weight?
No.
Oh.
You must also exercise and eat smart at every meal.
I see.
Do you know the Special K breakfast is less than 240 calories, 99% fat-free, and delicious?
No, but if you hum a few bars...
And that's another tale of the ball and chain.
Your happy ending could begin with the Kellogg's Special K breakfast.
That's Kellogg's Special K. Good night.
Back from the lavatory, I looked out the window at the parking lot. Old Hank Depression is still out there. He's fortifying himself with a couple of reserve packs of mustard he must have stolen the last time he was in. Well, we'll see if he sticks around, won't we? Well, it looks like I'm spang out of time here, and that's probably just as well because I've run out of Neil Hefti music. I mean, I've got more stuff from The Odd Couple, but you can't sit around and play that all day now, can you? But there was Is it? There's some. I keep thinking there's something else he wrote, and it's like it's really weird because it's at the tip of my tongue, but I can't name it. Ooh, that's so frustrating. What else did he write? I know it. It's a famous tune. Ugh. Well, you probably don't have it anyway. In any case, it'll come to me as soon as the show's done. That's just the way things work. I'd like to thank Neil Hefti for writing all that wonderful music, including that one I can't remember. And I'd like to thank you for dropping by the diner. I'm James Lilex, and this has been The Diner for Friday, October 17th, 2008. We'll see you down the road. Oh, I'm just kidding. He wrote this.
Everywhere they go, they are known as the couple. They're never seen alone, so they're known as the couple. As I've indicated, they are never quite separated. They are peas in a pod, don't you think that it's odd? Their habits I confess, none can guess with the couple. If one says no, it's yes, more or less with the couple. But they're laugh-provoking, yet they really don't know they're joking, don't you find? When love is blind, it's kind of odd. Don't you think it's odd? Don't you think it's odd? Don't you think it's odd?